Okay, so in high school, I hung out with this girl, Carrie, right? And Carrie was real pretty and sweet and everything, but Carrie had a rebel's heart. She started fights and she smoked cigarettes. She had books and movies and music that were all strictly forbidden for the likes of me, the crazy church boy. But I, like everyone else in school, really dug her. Of course, I was too shy to say anything. So I figured I'd go the buddy route, bide my time, and wait to see what might go down. And we were tight. One day, lying on the carpet in her living room, she reached out, took my hand, and she told me I was the best friend she ever had. I didn't want to be her best friend, but I figured it was something to build on. The next day, I saw Carrie and she was furious. Did you see it? Did you see it? Did you see it? What? Turned out the school administration had sent out an informational flyer addressed to all the parents in the high school. It read, "Does your teenager act tired or lethargic? Do they eat massive quantities of food one day and refuse to eat anything the next? Mood swings. Well, if you answer yes to any of these questions, your child is likely on the drugs. But help is only a phone call away." Now, you've got to understand, this flyer thing they sent out would have made zero impact in my house. If it wasn't about Jesus or the church, my parents were not interested. We never checked the mail except to dump it all in the trash. There were bills in there. A school brochure, please. So, no, I didn't see anything about the flyer. But Carrie wasn't having any of it. They're bullying us, and it's wrong. And the more she talked about it, the more she got everyone, including herself, riled up. I say we have a walkout. If we all sit together, we'll send a message that this is not the way we're going to be treated. Who's with me? Shoot, I'm with you. Fine, Carrie. They can't send pieces of paper to our house. So the plan was at 1:45 p.m., precisely during fourth hour, everyone was going to get up and walk out. So there we were, sitting in history class with Mr. Perkins, and he's going on about how some things are worth defending, some things are worth dying for. Then he stops and he says, "I hear there's going to be a walkout in a few minutes. Now the teachers know, and you know what? I'm not going to tell you what to do. You have to make that decision for yourself. But if you do something like this right before you graduate, you better know I can mark you. It can go on your permanent record. And in the end, you have to ask yourself, was it worth it? So take a stand if you need to, but make sure it's the stand you want to take." Everyone kind of looks over at everyone else. Mr. Perkins gives his teacher nod and goes back to history. 5 minutes till showtime. 3 minutes. 2:45. Carrie stands up, slams her books to the floor, and walks out. Alone. All by herself. Everyone's just looking straight ahead, possibly thinking what I'm thinking. Which is, yeah, we're with you in spirit, Carrie. But I don't know if it's really worth this fuss with the permanent record and all, but know that we're applauding you the whole way. Carrie disappears from view, and I see her return to the door frame, waiting for us, waiting for me, looking baffled and lost and small. And I remember when she reached out and took my hand and told me that I was her best friend. I stand up. I place my books gently upon the chair. I wave to the class, to Mr. Perkins. And I walk out into the hallway with Carrie. The super empty hallway. We're still hopeful, like maybe everyone's watches weren't quite synced up to the right time, but the halls remain empty. Crickets. So we walk out to the parking lot, stand around, kick rocks, not talking about it. And finally, I brave up. Hey, you think you and I could ever be boyfriend and girlfriend? Is that why you followed me out here? No. Maybe. I don't think so. When she reached out and held my hand that time, I knew it was a consolation prize. Like, we're still friends, right? And I thought, you know what? We are friends. Today in Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present The Pact. Amazing stories from real people who've got a promise to keep. My name is Glenn Washington. Buckle up, because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. Now, we're going to kick off today's Snap episode way, way south of the border. Christian Dunn played in a 16-piece party band in Colombia. He played for fun and to make some extra money. One night, after rocking out the countryside, he and his bandmates piled onto a bus for the long ride home through the mountains. But instead of making it straight home, they were going to have a much longer night than they thought.
So I was in a bus late at night, about 2 a.m. I guess. We were tired from performing. I thought the night was over when the bus stopped. I looked up to see three guys in camouflage uniforms and big guns. So they said, "Esto es una requisa. Bájense del bus. Get off the bus. We're gonna have to search you." We know that that area is red zone. It's dangerous in there because we know it's dominated from groups like guerrillas, and we were used to get stopped by different forces, sometimes the police, sometimes paramilitaries, sometimes guerrillas, but they all let us go as soon as they find out we are just musicians and never ask us to get out of the bus. So we get off the bus. We were leaning against the bus, hands up. And I was trying to figure out what did we do wrong. They couldn't take us for ransom because we were just struggling musicians. No one could tell we have any money. That was obvious. After they searched us and found out that we were right, we were just musicians, I thought, what's next? What was going on? Why is it taking too long to let us go? When they said, "You're gonna have to come with us. We're taking you." Oh man, that was the time when I started to get sick. I said, "This is bad. This is serious." I was dizzy. My heart was beating very fast. We knew people who had been taken or even killed by the guerrillas. So they told us, you have to come with us. And we were blindfolded. And we drive maybe like in about 30 minutes, I guess, with the bus inside the jungle. We got out of the bus. We already took off the blindfold. And they said, okay, we're gonna have to walk. So we were hiking in this place. It's dark, it's cold, with no light, just guiding from a guy with a flashlight. And we were walking probably like 20 minutes. And suddenly we start hearing the music far away. As close as we get, we could hear the music louder and we could see like more light. We finally found the camp. It was like a farm, what we called finca. They had a few light bulbs hanging in the wires, and the clearing they have like some speakers with a few microphones, and they have a mixer. And they said the commander was having a birthday party and he wanted a band to play in the party. We were just like nervous and also trying to follow the director. He said, okay, this is the place we're going to play. Let's set up our stuff. From the beginning, I was trying so hard to avoid seeing people directly in their eyes. Because, you know, you watch all those movies and like, oh, that guy saw me. We cannot let him go. So I was trying to look down, and that's why I guess I remember a lot of details about their clothes, because I wasn't looking down at their face. I was looking down at their bodies and the boots. Most of the people were actually carrying guns. Most of the people were wearing guerrillas uniforms. A lot of times we were using body language, especially like looking at each other, and like we tried to don't talk too much because we didn't want to bring any attention. Suddenly, we start seeing the people like really enjoying the music, having fun, and everybody was just happy and dancing. And I guess it was the first time for a minute we all kind of forgot where we were and with who we were with, and started kind of like smiling and laughing a little bit for real without me pretending to be nice to them. They were enjoying the music when we were just playing good. And as a musician, that always make you feel good, make you feel happy. And then gunshots. Pa, 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 pa. One of those guys very close to us start firing his gun up in the air. All the fun we were having, all the rock and roll mood changed. My first reaction in the moment was I really wanted to run, but I couldn't. It's like when you're having a dream, those kind of dreams that you see that somebody's gonna kill you and you try to run and you cannot. Your body feels like very slow. And we remember how messed up and how fragile our situation was at the time. Even they can kill you because they just can. They have the power. They can do it. The later they got, the drunker they got, the more worried we were, the more we felt like we needed to get out of there. Our band leader was trying his best to get us out, but it was hard because they really didn't want us to go. One of the guerrillas guy came and say, hey, do you guys want to eat some food? We have a lot of food. Come down and eat. When we were eating, we talked about, hey, so what's going on? When are we going back home? Did they tell you anything? We were asking the director. We were doing this quietly. Definitely, we were like, hey, so what's going on? Oh, yeah, don't worry. They already told me. They just want us to play a little bit more for the second set, and then we can go. And we say, hey, we should play some kind of like a slow song that they can make them like feel like sleepy or tired. They want to finish the party. It worked. We were playing like those slow songs, and for some reason they were like just like coming down. One of those drunk guys like were trying to like walk around with a bottle and show up, and then like I think I need to sit down or something. We see like people like spraying up more, like going to chairs and the tables. At some point, the guerrilla guy came and did the sign to the band leader, and the band leader told us, okay, cut. We can stop. Let's take off. I was happy, but not as much happy as when we were walking out in the forest again. Like breathing, I'm alive. But this time the sky was turning that orange pink color of the early morning before sunrise. We could see enough to find our way. I remember it was very quiet. We were silent, just making our way down the mountain, listening to the hundreds of birds that were waking up the forest. We promised each other that we wouldn't talk about that with anybody else. Never. Not even our parents, not even our girlfriends. Not because our fear of the guerrillas, but because the fear of the paramilitaries, who were the enemies of the guerrillas, who were controlling our hometown. And we knew that if they could get any information about we being playing for the guerrillas, it could be the end. They could kill us. I was feeling like I needed to talk about this a little bit, at least with my father. I was in the middle of this decision. I was thinking yes, and I was thinking also the danger it could bring. But when I was thinking about it, after 2 weeks, a neighbor that I knew from a long time ago, he got killed and thrown to the Magdalena River with a message in his teacher in his belly saying, esto le pasa por sapo. This happened to you because you were a snitch. This changed all my thoughts about sharing this with my father, because I knew if I could open my mouth, that could happen to me, and I couldn't be here telling this story.
We are so thankful that after recent changes in Colombia, Christian Don was finally able to share that story. Stay safe, and please keep playing the guitar. That piece was produced by Jennifer Dunn and Nancy Lopez, with sound design by Renzo Gorio. Now, when Snap Judgment continues, a guy makes a promise of epic proportions to himself, and a mother's child tries to fulfill her final wish. When Snap Judgment, the pact continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment. Today, we're exploring the power of a promise, the limits of a vow. Do people mean what they say? Should they? For our next story, we're cashing in all of our frequent flyer miles in order to head off to London. Snap favorite Jonathan Gruber has a story.
Stuart Sharp and his wife Jo ran a pub in the English countryside where he lived with his mom and daughter. On the eve of the birth of his first son, Stuart and his wife already had a name for the baby picked out. Ben. But things went badly during Ben's delivery.
And when we got to the hospital, she was in labor, and the doctor was there. It was, in those days, it was a very cold, frugal room, and she was lying on a slab like a lamb to the slaughter. It was a very strange environment. And the doctor was there, and suddenly he rushed past me out of the room, called the ambulance for the big center in Leicester. Eventually, we managed to get her to the hospital in Leicester, and we didn't know at that point that Ben was already dead.
Inside of her?
Yeah. She'd had a uterus rupture. When they did deliver Ben, they actually caused so much damage to her, she nearly died as well. So my wife was nearly dead, Ben was dead. It was devastating.
Wow. What'd you do?
I didn't know what to do.
Stuart buried Ben in a shoebox-sized grave. The night of the funeral, he went to bed and had a dream. A dream that would change his life.
And I was back at the graveside with Ben in the dream. I saw Ben rise from the coffin and sort of travel up towards the skies. And suddenly I started hearing this wonderful angelic music. And then I heard these angels came down and spoke to me. And one of the angels said to me, "Ben is safe now." And in these circumstances, we always leave somebody a gift. And the gift for you is you will remember everything. And I could hear every single note of this piece of music. I heard everything.
Yeah, can I just quickly stop you here and ask you, are you religious,
no,
Stuart?
No.
Do you believe in God?
No.
What did you think was going on?
I just thought there was some great spiritual power that was going to guide me to do what I was meant to do from Ben's death.
The music in Stuart's mind was so persistent, so urgent, that he decided to do something dramatic. He decided he had to devote the rest of his life to getting this music written and recorded, no matter what the cost. That meant leaving his wife and daughter and moving to London, despite having no formal musical training or musical talent. He waited a year to break the news to his wife and mother. It did not go well.
She said, look, you need therapy after what you've gone through. I understand. You need to go and talk to someone. And I said, I'll give you 6 months' notice, and in 6 months to the day, I'm going to leave for London. Of course, they both thought, sure. And they just shrugged it off. Yeah, 6 months. Every month I would say, 5 months to go, 4 months to go, a month to go, and they still thought it was a joke. And I said, listen, I'm serious. And when it came to the day of going, and I got my little old Ford car and my squash bag, and I said, I'm going. And my wife was like, what? Absolutely.
Because sure. There's a lot of people listening to this right now who are saying to themselves, you just abandoned your family, man.
Absolutely. I know that. I said to her, through this dream, I will make you extremely happy. We will travel the world together. The girls will go to places and see things and get an education they couldn't have dreamed of. That actually made it worse.
Yeah, because it sounds like the things you have to say to yourself to do something like leave your family.
Yeah.
It sounds like an excuse.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I left for London on that day.
What did it feel like when you got into that car and started driving towards London?
I felt that I was going to do what I was destined to do. I expected that the voices, the angels, would tell me exactly what to do. So I had never been to London before. It was very miserable weather. I drove along this road. I just kept going round in circles. The traffic was very heavy. I pulled off the road and found a car park. And I just stopped in the car park. I thought, well, I'll stay here. And it was a huge car park with garbage bins in the corner. So I parked in between the garbage bins and stayed there waiting for my next instruction.
And?
I didn't get one.
Stuart lived in his car, and Joe gave up waiting for him after 6 months. She divorced him. He stayed in London, waiting for the voices to tell him what to do. He sold his car, he moved onto the streets, but the voices said nothing. Stuart fell into despair and moved into a hostel for the homeless. He'd lost everything. Everything except the angelic music in his head. And then he walked by the window of a secondhand shop and saw a guitar.
And I'd only got a few pounds, whatever it was, in my pocket. And I said, this is all I've got. Is it possible you could drop the price? A very nice lady said, not really. What do you want it for anyway? I said, well, look, I'm going to compose a symphony and I need it to get the notes out so I can give it to someone else. And she eventually said, OK, you can have it.
What'd you do with it?
I took it back to the hostel. I used to sit in this little, tiny little room, which was full of cockroaches next to the kitchen. Cockroaches crawl over me every night, just trying to figure out this guitar. So while I'm fiddling around with these notes, I start being able to pick out some of the melody line on the guitar. I can do this. Yeah, I couldn't write the notes down, but what I did, I went back to the Townsend's shop and I bought from them for a very few pence a very old tape recorder. And I took it back and started playing all the melodies and stuff into this tape recorder until I'd filled 2 hours of this tape, everything I could hear. And so I thought, well, now I've got something I can work with.
One day, Stuart took his guitar and recorder and sat himself in front of the BBC studios close to the homeless shelter to try his luck at getting noticed.
And while I was sitting there, quite a few people walked by and thought I was begging, but I wasn't. And one gentleman came by and he just looked at me and didn't say anything. He walked on and he stopped 50 metres later and turned around and came back and said, what are you doing with the guitar? Are you a busker? I said, no, I'm writing a symphony. Oh, you're a composer? I said, well, sort of. He said, well, have you got a score? I said, no, I can't write music. And he went, how are you going to write a symphony then? I said, because I've got it on tape and I can play little bits of it. He said, where are you living? And I said, well, living rough, actually, and I'm living in a hostel for the homeless and just bumming around, really. I'm looking for the next stage in my development of this great story. He said, I'm a jazz musician. Look, why don't you come and stay with me for a couple of hours? I'll take you back to my house. I've got a piano. Let me hear your melodies, and I'll see what I can do on the piano, so if I can extemporize it for you. So I said, well, that's really kind of you, and he took me back to his house. His wife was absolutely furious. She said to him, are you going completely crazy? This guy could be a murderer. You've got a child, got a baby, and you're bringing him. Well, he was not going to stay long, just for a few hours. Just kindly make him a bit of soup or something. And I stayed there for 6 weeks. The first night, I started playing the melody, and he started feeling it on the piano. And in a couple of hours, what we had done on this piano, and I'm telling you, Jonathan, was phenomenal.
The jazz musician was Anthony Wade. And yes, this is actually audio from those original recordings in his house back in 1982. By the end of those 6 weeks, Stuart and Anthony had pretty well scored the entire symphony. Anthony said it was so good, it could make Stuart rich and famous and should be played by the London Philharmonia Orchestra. That was the good news.
my only advice to you is go out and make a fortune, because you will have to pay for it all yourself.
And how much?
Well, I mean, we're talking about over £1 million.
£1 million.
Because it's not just going to the Philharmonia Orchestra, as explained to me. You're going to need orchestrators. You're going to need arrangers. You're going to need the best studios in the world. You'll need a rehearsal orchestra. You'll need this, you'll need that, and you'll need the other. And before you do all that, we would have to work on it together to make an electronic version of it. And for that, you will need to hire a studio. You need to hire computers. And me will be very expensive, and so on and so forth.
So here you were, at the cusp of realizing your dream. Oh, and by the way, Mr. Homeless Man, you're going to have to pay £1 million to do it. What'd you think when he said that to you?
I was excited. You asked me to make £1 million, and I'll go and make £1 million.
He started off by getting a job at the homeless center. Then he got various sales jobs working exclusively on commission, something for which he showed an uncanny ability. He spent years flipping houses for the local council, and then he started doing it for himself. Many houses, and 15 years later, he had saved £1 million.
Then I tracked Anthony Wade down, and I said to him, "Are you ready to go?" He said, "Go where?" "The project." He couldn't quite work out what was going on, so I took my bank statement with me. I said, "Right, you gave me the answer of what to do. Here is the money. Let's go."
And how long did it take to complete?
It took 5 years working every single day to do an electronic version of the whole symphony. Once I got all that done, then I presented it to the conductor of the Philharmonia with the tape, with a score. "Please listen to this."
And
he was not too impressed, because how could a homeless person with no musical ability write a score that would be good enough for the London Philharmonia Orchestra? And he said to me, "It's not a question of money, Stuart. It's a question of credibility. The London Philharmonia Orchestra are not going to record basically rubbish."
He hadn't even listened to it.
He hadn't listened to it, no. And then a few weeks later, I got a call from him at midnight, and he was crying on the phone. He said, "Stuart, I have just listened to your tape. I have been blubbering for the last 5 minutes. It is wonderful. I cannot believe it. I'm so sorry I didn't listen to it before." The reason I didn't listen to it before is because I thought, how can I break the bad news to you after all you've gone through? But now I can see that with the London Philharmonia recording it, this will be one of the most magnificent things we've ever done.
Stuart needed to find even more money. It needed to be scored again. The orchestra had to be booked years in advance. And then, one day, the conductor of one of the greatest orchestras in the world turned to Stuart and said,
"Now it is right for the London Philharmonia Orchestra."
Okay, so the day comes of the recording. Describe the room to me.
It was a very big room to enclose 80 musicians. It was a big recording studio in London, massive. Oh my God, is this really going to happen?
It's the sound, they're all tuning their instruments.
They were all tuning their instruments, and the hairs on the back of my neck are going, standing up, because I don't know what to expect. I don't know whether it's going to be what I heard in my head or something else.
When the moment came when the conductor stood before them,
when the one came down, and as they started to play, it was exactly what I heard in my head. The trumpet call for the angels, the voices, choir, because I had a big choir as well. I had a massive choir. It wasn't just an orchestra. It was a big choir joining in. It was exactly going in sync, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, is that the orchestra doing it, or is that what is my head? It was so strange. And when they'd finished, suddenly I heard this noise. It was like applause. And the conductor said, "Stuart, come over here. This ovation is for you."
It's hard to know if the musicians of the London Philharmonia were applauding for the music, or Stuart's journey, or both. Nevertheless, they gave him a standing ovation. Alan Wilson, the conductor of the London Philharmonia, is quoted as saying, "I had to admit I was stunned. I've never seen any orchestra anywhere in the world give any composer an ovation like that before." Stuart's symphony has never been performed. It's never been distributed by a major record label, but he had achieved his goal. Stewart had gotten the music out of his head and recorded by one of the greatest orchestras in the world.
What's the first thought that went
through your head? The first thought that went through my head, I can't wait to send this to my ex-wife. I can't wait to send it to her because it's so beautiful. I'm sure it won't hurt her because... And she knew the journey I'd had, and I sent the CD to her, and I got a call from her the next day. I didn't know what she was going to say. And she said, Stuart, I played your Angelus Symphony, and I've had the windows open, and I've played it full blast. I have to tell you, it is magnificent. And I cried.
Let me ask you. You created a lovely family. You had a terrible tragedy, but your family was still intact. Then you had this dream that came to you that, frankly, could have been psychosis for all we know. If you had to do this all over again, would you do it the same way?
I didn't have any choice. You've been given a gift, go and use it. So there's no choice for me.
Was it worth it?
I don't know.
Thanks for sharing your story, Stuart. That piece was produced by Jonathan Gruber. He's the host of the amazing podcast, The State We're In. Distributed by WBEZ, I highly recommend it. The piece was edited by Anna Sussman with sound design by Pat Macedi Miller. There are some promises you never want to make, never ever. Find out what they are when Snap Judgment, the packed episode, continues. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the packed episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and there are some promises that you make when you really don't have a choice. David Dobbs' mother was at the very end of her life. It was a time for last words and final requests. The family gathered all around. David's mother spoke.
She made this strange request of us in the Methodist hospital.
David Dobbs and his five siblings were at the bedside of their aging mother, Evelyn Jane.
It seemed possible that she could die. So it was fairly solemn. And then she said that she wanted to talk about after. And we all understood that to mean after she died.
Her first strange request was that she be cremated, which was a surprise. Her kids always thought she wanted to be buried with her parents. But, okay, last-minute change of heart, that makes sense.
And then she said, and I want my ashes spread in the water off of Hawaii. This was a complete stunner. We all looked around the room at each other, you know, thinking, well, maybe there's something we don't remember, or I never learned and you did. But shrugs all around, you know, and quizzical looks. We were all obviously completely in the dark as to why she would want this. And Sarah said, sure, Mom, we can do that. Can we ask why Hawaii? And she said, I want to be with Angus.
Angus was someone David's mother only mentioned once, when David was a little kid. He knew that he was a man that she loved once, and that he died in World War II. Otherwise, David knew basically nothing about the guy. Since the war, she'd been married, had kids. David had no idea why Angus would be so important 5 decades later. And he never got a chance to ask her, because a month later, his mother died.
My brother honored her wishes and took her ashes out to Hawaii. And rented a kayak and went out into this one bay and dumped her ashes into the water and watched it curl down to the coral there. And he sent pictures of all this and a description. And somehow seeing the pictures and thinking about her actually down there stirred this up in me. I suddenly decided I want to find out who this guy was, if I can.
The natural place to start for David was his mother's cousin, Betty Lou, the closest thing his mother had to a sibling.
So I called Betty Lou and asked her what she knew of this, and she said a lot. She told me that, because all I had was Angus, which I assumed might be a nickname. And Betty Lou said, yes, that was a nickname. I'm trying to remember what his name is, she said. Norman, I think it's Norman. And it starts with a Z, the last name. And he disappeared really close to the end of the war. Oh, the one other thing, this is very important, that Betty Lou remembered, was that he was from one of those I states. Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, one of those.
So David started with Iowa. He found a register of fallen soldiers, of which there were thousands, each listed by the 99 counties in the state. So David started from the top. Adair County, no. Adams County, nope. Black Hawk, Chickasaw, Ida, Hancock County, no. Norman Z. Then, at the end of Johnson County, he found a Norman E. Zart. So he looked up every Zart he could find in the entire state of Iowa, and he emailed them.
And I got a bunch of no's. And then one day I got a yes. This is a story of like multiple sort of shocks. And that was when I got the first one, which was a response from a David Zart, who wrote back saying, yes, I know Norman E. Zart. Norman E. Zart was my father. I was just assuming this was a young, single man. And I find out that my mother, who was a sort of paragon of moral rectitude, she was in an affair with a man with two children.
Norman was a married man. He had a daughter named Christy and a son, also named David.
David wrote, I'm reading from the letter here, I don't have words to describe the mixed emotions that come to me when I revisit this issue. You can imagine that this inquiry, meaning my email, fills me with questions, he wrote. And then he had 19 questions for me, which were kind of a mix of prosecutorial and curious. I've come to learn that in the process of growing up, one accumulates scars. And the challenge is learning to own your scars and live them. It was clear from his letter. The one thing that was clear was that these kids are 7 and 5 when he disappears. And ever since then, they had in some sense been wondering who broke up their family. That person was my mother.
David and Christy also knew next to nothing about Norman because he died when they were so young. They knew there was an affair, but that was it. And they gave him the go-ahead on his search for Norman. The search would last nearly a decade. What David figured out was that in 1943, his mother met Norman on an Air Force base where they were stationed. One night, a friend convinced him to go out on a double date, just a casual thing. His date was David's mother, Evelyn Jane. This is where their love affair started. In a letter to his friend, later explaining the affair, Norman wrote,
she was very intelligent, sharp, good dancer, pretty, wonderful figure, etc., etc. Does that sound like I'm gone? I told her I was married the first night. She's been married, divorced, to some guy who must have been awfully stupid not to realize what a good thing he had. I realized that similar statement might aptly apply to me. You'd like to know something of her, I suppose. She's a woman in love, so naturally she wants the obvious. But she's very broad-minded about it. And what about me? I want her. She's the kind of gal I'd consider marrying, if I weren't already. And I haven't seen many of those. This all may seem to be written very calmly. It is fairly so, but it was not arrived at calmly. There has been a tremendous battle of Zart versus Zart going on for the past 6 months. But after battling with myself over and over, I seem to get the same answer. I want this gal. I'll never get her out of my mind.
It was 1944, and the Allies were winning the war.
Germany had surrendered. The war in Europe was over.
The Pacific was the last front to go. When Norman was stationed in Hawaii, Evelyn followed him to the tropics. only pictures that David found after his mother died tell the story.
So there's all these pictures of him and some of my mom, some of them together, while they were in Hawaii. They're just clearly, utterly in love. And there's another one where she's looking at the camera. And my mother was a really, really good-looking woman. She was a knockout. And she's looking at the camera, and it's a light coming out of her eyes that, unless you're a really good actor or actress, you only see it when someone's just really in love.
But as blissful as they were, the war raging on the horizon was never far from their minds.
And there's another picture. They do not look happy. Angus is looking straight at the camera. He's got aviator sunglasses on, and he's looking kind of sternly at this camera, which is down low. And my mother is looking off to the right, and she looks stricken. And that just spoke of a sense of trouble to come.
Norman was trained to fly dangerous rescue missions over the ocean. Evelyn must have understood the risk when Norman was called to duty. Evelyn Jane went back to the mainland to wait for him to come home. She would never see him again.
The war was 2 weeks over. Everyone had celebrated. People were starting to hear from, you know, their kin that were coming home. And my mother gets this letter from a buddy of Angus's in his unit, saying that Angus had gone out on a mission about 2 weeks before the war ended, and the plane vanished with the crew. This letter just destroyed Evelyn Jane, my mother. Just shattered her. For weeks, she was a mess. Just destroyed her.
Evelyn moved on to become a doctor, and eventually she got married and had 5 kids. As a kid, David remembers playing with a gold locket hung around his mother's neck. When he would click it open, there was a picture of his grandparents inside of it. Right before she died, she sent it to her cousin. But when her cousin opened it...
The grandparents' picture is not there. What's in there is Angus's picture, a picture of Norman. Norman's picture was behind that picture all the time. She carried Norman around her neck for 55 years.
Evelyn went to her grave imagining Norman still out in the Pacific, and she imagined her ashes would be with his. Except that David discovered just one other thing. Norman wasn't in the Pacific. Because she wasn't next of kin, Evelyn was never told that his body was found in a shallow grave in Japan 4 years after he went missing. He was reburied in Northern California. The remains were still thousands of miles apart. Even in death, Norman and Evelyn never would be together.
So I had that photo album, and there were spaces at the end of it. There was a picture of him in there, quite a few good pictures of him, and one was on the last page, and there was an empty spot. It was one of those things where there's 4 little corners you put the photo in. There was a little spot next to it. I printed out 2 pictures. I printed out a picture of his gravestone, and I printed a picture of her gravesite. The spot on the water with the lays in it that my brother had dropped, where he put her ashes. And I put those 2 pictures on the last page in adjacent little squared off spots in this photo album. It's impossible to, and it wouldn't be my place to like put them together. So they're not really touching. They're still apart. But I figure that's as close as I could get them.
Thanks so much to David Dobbs for sharing your story with The Snap. Now, we heard about this piece from the amazing multimedia publisher, The Atavist. We'll have a link on our website to theatavist.com. That piece was produced by Julie DeWitt with sound design by Nancy Lopez. You made a pact with yourself, and you made good, Snap Nation. But there's even more Snap goodness where this came from. Podcasts, movies, full episodes, snapjudgment.org. Facebook, Snap Judgment. Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and the team that promises everything and delivers. The Uber producer, Mark Ristich, Pat Massey Miller, Anna Sussman, Julia DeWitt, Renzo Gorio, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Jasmine Aguilera, and Will Urbina. We apologize for earlier assertions that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting maintains their head office at Area 51, that might not be true. Much love to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, exchanges public radios for whatever is in your pocket. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago is the place of WBEZ in Chicago. And you know this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could meet a pretty girl in France, promise her that you'll return to that train station in precisely 1 year. And then you could meet her there by accident in 2 years, holding the hand of your new girlfriend as you show her this cool train station you went to once, and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.